Hey, Arnab, good morning. Welcome, all of you, again and again. Yesterday we had a more informal welcoming gathering for our UK retreat, but the welcoming is never ending. Can always be welcomed into a deeper way of inhabiting space, time, each other, ourselves, relationships. So the welcoming never ends because the journey never ends. So you have finally arrived to some point. There's no need to say welcome anymore, right? Because you're already there. So it doesn't make sense. But if the arrival is always a further arrival, there's always a further welcome to that further arrival. So if you hear the word welcome too many times per day, that's it. That's the point we are trying to make, right? Hopefully we get accustomed to that because those are the dynamics of eternity. When Gopa Kumara arrives to Golok Vrindavan, as it's described in Brihad Bhagavatamrita, Krishna tells him many times, welcome you. He doesn't say welcome. He says, welcome, welcome, welcome. Yeah, and I'm most happy, most happy, most happy you're here. So many times to say welcome. There's so many things to be welcomed into. So we are beginning today, and as we shared yesterday, the idea was to spend our mornings trying to contemplate different scriptural passages from our Gaudiya Vaishnava tradition and try to dive deep into them, not merely as an intellectual exercise, but as a contemplative exercise, as bhakti, as seva. It's non-different. Sometimes recently someone asked a Vaishnava, okay, what's the difference between scriptural study and service? He say what I will have said, so I was happy he said that. He said, like, both are the same thing. Scriptural study is service. I don't think seva is washing the pots, and scriptural study is intellectual indulgence. They can be both. Seva can be washing the pots and opening a shastra. You can do it from a place of intellectual indulgence, but ideally, both are seva. So we are trying to put this together. I remember some weeks ago, I was talking to Yamuna. Yes, she. And she said, oh, that will be. I asked her, because to be honest, as I told you, I think yesterday I was not very sure what to speak about this retreat, because previous retreats, maybe we brought topics from my previous books, but my next book is not yet published. So, we could have done it as a trailer, but probably we'll do it next year. We'll see. So, what to speak about? And there are so many things we could talk about. And she mentioned, well, maybe we can talk about contemplation in bhakti as opposed, so to say, as to doing in bhakti. Because sometimes, again, the idea is so much about human doing, bhakta doing, rather than contemplation and being and experiencing. So I felt, okay, maybe going through these different passages from Shastra is a way of doing that. If a way of putting together both and understanding our doing is meant to be contemplation, and our contemplation is a form of doing, is an action. It's not like contemplation just means I'm just sitting with eyes closed. That's a form of it, but everything else should be an extension of contemplation, right? So I thought, okay, let's select some few verses from Shastra and let's try to contemplate them. To invest some intentional time and attention into, drilling in certain particular sections, which are very dear personally to me, that I'd like to share with you. And again, this is a doing and this is contemplation. We are doing contemplation. We are sitting, we are listening, we are taking notes, we are thinking. All that can be labeled as doing, but all that can be labeled as contemplation. So trying to reach that point where the two become one, when there's no longer need to speak in terms of, okay, now comes my doing, now comes my time for contemplation. But it all became one. And for that, of course, we will be also, as I say yesterday, spending some time in silence during the day, also sitting with the verses, writing, reflecting, praying. We'll share more later. But yeah, the idea is hopefully we can get a glimpse of how everything we do is contemplation. And again, contemplation is not absolute inaction, especially in our tradition, because maybe in other traditions, the notion of contemplation may lead more to a, I don't know, an idea of eternity, more passive eternity. I don't know, Santa Rasa, as we hear in our tradition. Tarasa could be passive contemplation. In our school, we hear about different forms of mukti, none of which are something much more of our interest, at least not officially, maybe an interest for some of you. And some of them are like residing in the same planet as God. Not even close, in close proximity, but you happen to be in the same planet. And you're content with that. Wow, it's cool. I'm in the same planet as God. Lovely. Right? No? Salokya Mukti. No? I don't need more. It's not that I need to be serving on a daily basis and interact. Just we happen to be on the same planet. Okay, satisfied. And or I can sit and think about God's attributes, contemplate the beatific vision as intended will use in Christianity. In our tradition, we hanker more for a radically personal interaction with everything and everyone, starting with the divine. So, not to downplay or to criticize other forms, they are all valid and they all have a place in eternity. But our line is more active celebration, active seva, with active depth. So again, active celebration, active seva doesn't mean like to be freaking out, doing, becoming human doings nonstop. But there is a place for action and interaction and celebration and love and dedication and relationality. So we try to get a glimpse of that. That's contemplation as well. So we'll be sharing one verse per day. You already have a glimpse of the one we'll be sharing today. And each verse, I mean, there are so many verses. I had big trouble selecting verses because there are so many that I feel like, oh, this will be great to share. This is a favorite of mine. This is another one. But I can only select eight. So that was so cruel. But they are very deep part of my heart. But just know these are eight only. So they are. We do not only have eight parts in our heart, we have many more. So these are parts of extending my heart to you, and hopefully they become part of your heart. Hopefully they're already part of your heart, or if they are, they can always become more part of your heart. And again, these are, remember what we talked in our series on the Srimad Bhagavatam, that we got to the introduction point, which was we do not approach Shastra as a book that we open and we get some information, we close it, and that's it. It's a living reality. And I'm not so much meant to open the book, but the book is meant to open me. And when I'm reading a verse, it's not like a museum piece. I put a few letters put together, but it's a very living reality that I'm invited to engage in conversation with. And so the verse is talking to me. The verse is inviting to participate in it. To think of how this verse is reflecting back where I am in my life. And we'll get to the verse in a moment, of course, to every verse. But again, it's not so much learning, memorizing, knowing how to translate it and recite it and be a nice, good boy and good girl. Yeah, I know the verse in Maharaj is teaching in the morning. But trying to enter into the verse, to live into the verse, to make these sections part of our life. Again, this we call them verse, but you can call them a portal into reality. You use the word that works better for you. A shloka, verse, passage, portal, living reality. It's just a way of a sound articulation of the ultimate truth. So that's why we need to spend time with each one of them, not just like reading them. Okay, next verse. Okay, next verse. Okay, next verse. Not like we did in Switzerland some days ago. Okay, let's talk about Gadarpandi for a week. Oh, no. Maybe most of us have heard about Gadarpandi for 7 minutes in their life. Now, okay, let's say 7 days. Really? What else can be said about what I heard in my first 7 minutes? A few things can be said. So same with verses like this. I'm picking this verse to start, and I'll go in a minute. I could just have picked this verse and say, okay, we'll stay with this verse for the next 8 days, and I'm sure so much to mine, and not to sound exploitative from, no, from this ocean. So for me, all these are exercises for us to also have a glimpse of, oh, how much is in a verse, how much is in a word, how much is in a syllable. We could like stay there forever, actually. We are touching infinity. No? Basically, we are touching Nityam, Nityam, eternal. Ding. No? Oh, you can stay there. Nityam, what it means, eternal, eternality. Yeah, 8 days for that minimum. So that's the important thing here. Whatever part you touch, it's a portal into the endlessness. We don't take these teachings, these revelations for granted. Oh yeah, I already know that verse. Yeah, I learned it 25 years ago. I can even recite it by heart. It's great, but still, there's so much more there. As we say the other day, when Prabhupada finished his translation of the Gita, someone asked him, so what's your next publication? Oh, I was thinking about translating the Gita and writing a commentary. You just did that. He was like, huh. Yes. You don't get it. So many commentaries can be written, so many renderings can be made, so many things can be said about not only one book, but again, one verse, about one word, one syllable. This is the realization of the highest soul. So I would say just, and for us it may sound like sheer exaggeration, no? Like just one half a syllable of Krishna's name can provide you everything. We're like, you're a fanatic. And they are on the other side and they're like, no, that's true. I'm feeling it. I'm living it. And we are like, you're a religious fundamentalist. Just have a syllable. We are too skeptical. We cannot believe it because we have not lived it. No, but when you are living it, you don't need to believe anything. You're already living it. So that's the idea. Now that's how the Bhagavatam begins, right? Parikshit Maharaj asks in Sukadeva, I have 7 days to live. Is that enough time for me to attain all that what I want to attain? And Sukadeva was saying, and chuckled, like, enough, seven days you have? That's a lot of time. Just one moment is enough. As we will see today, this verse a lot about Sadhu Sangha. Sadhu Sangha Sarva Shastra Lava Matra Sarva Siddhi. One Lava Matra, one. Now, matra in Sanskrit is a nanosecond. 1 nanosecond of sadhu sangha sarva siddhi ho. It gives all perfection. And again, we may be like, ah, come on. 1 nanosecond of sadhu sangha, all perfection. That's absolutely disproportionate. Now, I'm having 25 years of sadhu sangha and no perfection at all. That's absolutely disproportionate. That's the other thing is more realistic. What has been going on in the name of Sadhu Sangha in those last decades? So there we have all these dates, quotes in the scripture, right? Like half a syllable of the name gives all perfection, half a moment of Sadhu Sangha. But they are not exaggeration. That's why we are prevented in this list of Namapara. Don't think these are artabad or exaggerated ornamentation. Sometimes scripture uses that for some purpose in some cases, but not in this case. So anyhow, let's try to dive deep into our Gaudiya Vaishnava tradition, no? And let's fall in love with it. That's the idea, not just to be an official member of an institution or card-carrying member of whatever, but a deeply committed, alive participant into something I've fallen in love with. And we are here to fall in love with everything. So that's how I decided. Okay, let's go into this verse because again, as much as And we all love this and we all do that. As much as I love and appreciate sister traditions and I engage in conversation with them and we have so many beautiful moments and I draw so much nourishment. I'm a Gaudiya Vaishnav. I'm too biased in that direction. I cannot but. So I felt okay, let's focus and without diminishing or criticizing anything, but let's fall in love deeply with this thing that gets at us together here. So I will be bringing some verses. I have decided most of them. I'm still thinking about a few others, hopefully complementary verses, but all of them talking in one way or another about bhakti, what bhakti is, in this case, sadhusanga, which is an aspect of bhakti, also in a way that hopefully helps us to clarify or even heal previous misunderstandings of certain sections of scripture, of certain words or notions that somehow were internalized in a relatively toxic, if not traumatizing way. So trying to put all that into place. Okay. Do you sign in? Okay. So then fasten your seatbelts. Welcome to our flight 108, Bodia Airlines. How do you call the people who serve the
stewards?
I'm your steward, Swami Padmanabh. Someone needs some water. So we are starting today. I thought, okay, let's start with this verse, which is a verse about what we are supposed to be doing throughout these next 8 days, just to set us straight, which is Sadhu Sangha. Well, this is a verse about Sadhu Sangha, as we will see in a moment. And of course, Sadhu Sangha is not something that we're invited to engage in during the next 8 days. And on the ninth day, we're invited to not do that. The invitation is all open, it's always voluntary. But Sadhu Sangha is something that we want to do forever. Say, we spoke yesterday, we want here to have glimpses of eternity. We want to be experiencing moments. I hope our retreat is deeply experiential, not just theoretical. A theory creates experience. And so Sadhusanga is deeply experiential. We want to feel, as I like to say, oh, I could be doing this forever. We already hopefully have some of those glimpses in our life. I see myself doing this perpetually. Okay, if you have that experience, you are touching eternity. And Sadhusanga is a huge part of this. Things we want to touch, at least personally, I want to touch for eternity. There's this beautiful verse before going to our official verse. I will bring in other verses in the context of the official verse. I may not have time to write all of them in the whiteboard, but you can ask me if you would like to delve more into that, the details, the quotes. But Chaitanya Charitamrita say Krishna Bhakti Janma Mool Hai Sadhu Sangha, Krishna Prem Janme Tenho Punar Mukhya Anga. Basically means Krishna Bhakti Janma Mool Hoy Sadhu Sangha. So the root cause that gives birth to bhakti is Sadhu Sangha. That's another conversation, but bhakti comes from Sadhu Sangha, which means bhakti comes from bhakti, because Sadhu Sangha is bhakti, which means bhakti is not inherent in the jiva. Anyhow. It's clear in the Chaitanya Charitamrita. That's not the topic of today's conversation. So Krishna Bhakti Janma Mool Hoy Sadhu Sangha. Bhakti comes from Sadhu Sangha. Well, this verse makes the whole shows this whole trajectory. The whole bhakti that we are trying to practice and embrace, the source is Sadhu Sangha. Which is another way of saying the source is bhakti. Bhaktiya Sanjataya Bhaktiya. Bhakti comes from bhakti. And bhakti takes to bhakti. Therefore, Krishna Prem Janme Tenho Punar Mukhya Anga. And when you attain Krishna Prem, no, when you develop divine love, the highest development, Punar Mukhya Anga, still this Sadhu Sangha remains or becomes even, it's interesting, Mukhya Anga. Mukhya means principle, Anga means like in this case, like limb or expression of bhakti. So sadhu sangha is crucial to begin bhakti because you cannot begin without it. But it's not like, oh, eventually as I begin my bhakti and I get along with this sadhu sangha stuff, the more I advance, I can relinquish sadhu sangha because now I have pre Krishna prem. But I'm on my own with my divine love. Chaitanya Charitamrita say no. Actually, the more you advance in bhakti, the more sadhu sangha becomes primordial and important. It's not the other way around. Not like other paths that, okay, I embrace some sadhanas and practice, and the more I get closer to the goal, the more my sadhana diminishes for me to really relinquish all that and go to my desired goal. Not like, I don't know, people will do tapasya to get to Swargalok. So they deprive themselves of many things so they can enjoy wildly there. It's very interesting, right? Or some people practice jnana here and certain practices to eventually merge in Brahman. But when they merge in Brahman, they stop doing all the things they did before the merging. But in bhakti, bhakti is the beginning, the middle, and the end. So the more we advance in bhakti, the more all the things we were already doing become more important. We are not relinquishing anything, but whatever is already there becomes all the more prominent. And sadhu sangha is no exception to that rule, because as sadhu sangha is the beginning of bhakti, in one sense you can say sadhu sangha is the culmination of bhakti. So Krishna prem janmeten apunarmukhya angat. All this to say, we are this verse is not today's verse, not about what we are supposed to be doing only today or these days, but for the rest of forever. And even more, again, the closer we get to the goal, and there's no end to that, the more important this communion of like-hearted souls becomes. Okay, let's go to the verse. That was just my introduction to the verse. And to the series these days, right? So this is a verse from Bhagavad Gita, 10th chapter. It's called Vibhuti Yoga. And the ninth verse. So I'll recite the verse. You have it here in the whiteboard. You can write it down or Madgata Prana Bodhayanta Parasparam Khatayantas Cha Ramanti Cha. Srimad Bhagavad Gita Ki Jai. We have a translation there. There are many ways, of course, to translate verses. So this is one. It says, those whose minds are attached to me, Krishna speaking here, and whose very life is consecrated unto me, feel great satisfaction and delight by ever enlightening each other and conversing about me. So the verse never says this is sadhu sangha, but this is sadhu sangha. So beautiful verse. There's so much to unpack here. So we'll not do justice to it by unpacking it in the next hour because it demands so much more. But again, just having some glimpses of this. And you feel free in time to go to different commentaries written. The Bhagavad Gita, Srila Prabhupada, Srila Siddhar Maharaj, very interesting commentary. Bhaktivinoda Thakur, Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur, Baladevi Devotion, Ramanujacharya, and so on and so forth. I mean, I will be referring briefly to that, but again, if we will just enter into the details, as I say, it's just one verse per retreat, which we can do in the future. It's an interesting project. I think I remember once we were in Jagannath Puri with Madhavananda Prabhu. Some of you may know him. We were giving a lecture together in at Gambira, the place where Mahaprabhu spent his last 12 years in seclusion. And he made the nice point, who was like, I mean, he said, well, we are visiting this place now. Later, we'll go to some other place. But actually, there's so much to say about what's. I mean, Mahaprabhu spent his last 12 years here. There's a lot that happened here. Minimum, we need 12 years to say what happened in those 12 years. I mean, he spent more than 12 years, but in seclusion were 12 years. So he said, we could just, because they were having a retreat for a week. I said, we could just be doing 1 week retreat just in Gambira. Which, of course, for many is no, let's visit all the other places in Jagannath Puri. Okay. But we could just stay here, come every single day to the same place, and go deeper and deeper and deeper. So, the same again with this verse, with anything. Nathan Goswami said, even a blade of grass properly approached can give you all perfection. So another retreat will just do a blade of grass retreat. Lessons from a blade of grass. How to approach a blade of grass correctly so it gives all perfection. That would be an interesting experiment for sure. Good idea. All kidding. So this verse 9 from chapter 10. This is one of four verses on the Bhagavad Gita called Chatur Shloki. Chatur Shloki basically means four verses. So these are four essential verses in the Bhagavad Gita that have been specially highlighted by Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur, but they became kind of the whole tradition kind of took that designation, said four verses from chapter 10, from verse 8 to 11. So these four verses kind of encapsulate the essence of the Bhagavad Gita. Again, we could do a whole retreat about those four verses. I will be just touching up on this one, this retreat. We have done that in the past, those series of lectures on the Chatur Shloki in English or Spanish. No, I don't. I cannot differentiate in my mind. So before going to this verse, briefly, I'll touch on the previous one for context. Because again, Bhagavad Gita is not like a random, chaotic compilation of verses, but there is some concatenation, no? Like one coming in connection to the other. So the previous verse, which is the first of the four verses of the Chatur Shloki, Krishna says, also famously, Aham Sarvasya Prabhu Mata Sarvam Pravartate Iti Matva Bhajante Mam. Buddha Bhava Samambita. So he's basically saying, he's revealing who he is. Aham Sarvasya Prabhu. From me, everything emanates. Janmadiyasyajata, that's how the Vatam begins. Everything's born out of me. Sarvam, Aham Sarvasya Prabhu, Sarvam, Mata Sarvam Pravartate. From me, everything comes. I'm the source of everything. It's a pretty Aishwaric statement. But at the same time, which makes this point, okay, I'm the source of everything. So another way of saying it is everything is sourced in me. So whatever you see comes from that source. Right? Therefore, everything is sacred. Everything is connected with that source. And then he says, Buddha Bhava Samambita, Hamsarvasa Atasarvam iti matva bhajante mam Buddha bhava samam. Those who know this, those who know who I am, dedicate their mind and intelligence and heart to engage in bhajan, to worship me. So in the previous verse, Krishna is already talking about his devotees, about who he is, and who my devotees are, or how my devotees act in connection to who I am. I am the source of everything. And those who know how I'm the source of everything, not only that I am the source of everything, but in which way I'm the source of everything, in which charming, loving, sweet, unconditionally tender way, they cannot but irresistibly engage in loving me. So now this verse comes to describe how those devotees engage in bhajan. Because the previous verse said, those who know who I am as the source of everything, who recognize everything's sourcing the divine, they engage in my bhajan, they engage in my adoration. I like more the word adoration than worship. Because worship's tales and distance. Adoration is like adorable. Something's adorable for me. It's adorable. So they engage in my adoration. How? Here you have it. And very interestingly, I mean, I'm not saying that there are no other forms of adoration, but the main thing, way in which Krishna is describing how my devotees adore me, he's not saying they offer me like tons of incense and 3,000 rounds of lamps and chant 16 rounds and do this or do that. I'm not against any of that, just in case. But they say, they absorb in me by conversation and communion and gathering and talking to each other. So beautiful. So here we start to see a Sambandha, an Abideya, and a Prayojana. Sambandha, Krishna say, I'm the source of everything. Everything is connected to me. Everything is interconnected, interrelated, because everything is source in me. That's Sambandha, very briefly. I'm the source of everything, which means everything is source in me. Everything is interconnected. Reality is relational. Sambandha. No? Previous verse. And then the natural response to that, Abhideya. Practice, response to Sambandha. Dedicate to adore him. How? This verse comes. And at the end of this verse, we'll see to Shanti Charamanticha starts to give the prayojan, the fruit. All my devotees find great to Shanti, great Ramanti. No, they find great, how to say, great satisfaction to Shanti and great delight. Ramanti. So that's a fruit, a sweet fruit, relished. So again, going back to our theme of contemplation that we mentioned before, this verse describes what happens with when contemplation becomes relational. This verse is very much relational, speaking about sadhu sangha, speaking about the verse starts with the word those, and then the translation. It's in the plural. It includes more than one person. So devotees do not merely think about Krishna privately. Of course, there is a place for private adoration, bhajan, but the fruit of that also, it's like it overflows in sangha. And many times, as we always say, sangha creates its own fruit that cannot be created by personal practice. Certain things we are invited to do in personal practice, some other things can only happen in communion. But that communion will happen if everyone comes with their own personal integrity, so to say. Because if we get together as a gang of self-deceiver people, there won't be much anything interesting happening in communion. It will be sheer chaos and a masking parade, basically. But if everyone comes from a place of integrity, having done their homework and some inner homework as much as they, then oh, you put all that together, you sit all those at the same table. Again, we are relational beings, as we were talking yesterday. So we do not exist by ourselves. We do not exist in isolation. Even our privacy is never absolutely private. If I say, okay, I'm going to my room by myself, you are never alone. Krishna is following you in your heart, whatever you go to. So we are relational. We are never entirely alone, though that's kind of the greatest tragedy that we keep feeling that so much. No, that's again another conversation. But so Sangha or Sadhu Sangha helps to make that reality even all the more evident. No? You are not alone, you are relational, you're interconnected, and so many things can happen when we can come from a place of integrity and show up courageously to each other or one another. So, in connection to this verse, there are many levels in which this verse can be read. Many levels, like every verse. For example, Srila Siddhar Maharaj, in his commentary of the Bhagavad Gita, he has a commentary, the Bhagavad Gita, which where he gives commentary to a few verses. In the whole Bhagavad Gita, not many, but those in itself are justify the whole presentation. They're incredible. And he concentrates on the Chatur Shloki of the Bhagavad Gita. I won't go excessively in detail in that direction here because, again, that will require different retreat and you can read the commentary yourself. But he will explain these four verses in connection to how they speak about the gopis of Vrindavan. So he's taking them to the highest of the highest. I will briefly mention something, but another way of reading this verse, okay, this verse speaks about pure devotees. Maybe not necessarily gopis of Vrindavan, but also not necessarily practitioners, sadhakas, but very advanced people. For example, by Mad Gata Prana, the expression Mad Gata Prana means prana means life air. So one way to read Mad Gata Prana is, my devotees cannot maintain their life without me. So the verse can be read as speaking about those devotees who are on the verge of death and separation, who are really that dependent. Like the example sentence, like a fish cannot live without water, the same way my devotees cannot live without me. So that's a high caliber way of re reading this verse, which again is possible. So we can read it in different ways, but I like to concentrate more on where some most of us may be, which is probably not there. I'm sorry if I'm judging you. I don't know. No, I don't know. I don't know. I'm talking, I can only talk for me. While still keeping these higher meanings and possible readings in mind aspirationally, no? Because we don't want just to make everything fit into where I am. No? I mean, we want the verse to be relatable to where we are, but also we want to keep the verse open to all that it means, so that it opens and offers me like a prospect to aspire for. Even if I'm not there in short, middle, long term, still I can have that clear prospect, so I can develop a clear aspiration. We need some clear prospect to have a clear sense of aspiration. And that's very important. Not only what do I need now and how everything relates to where I am now, yes, but also prospect, no, aspiration, that's longing, that's helping. So, so going back to the theme of contemplation, this verse speaking about contemplation. This verse reconciles very nicely contemplation and activity. But the verse speaks about speaking. Oh, my devotees speak about me. And speaking is action, it's doing. I'm speaking. That is also contemplation. Speaking about Krishna is contemplation. Others are listening. If someone is speaking, there's listening is an action. But it's also contemplation. Their friendship, the nature of the interaction, the love in between them in the bond, that's a form of contemplation. In other words, their contemplation has become embodied as relationship. That's a nice way to put it. No? Sadhu Sangha is embodied contemplation. No? Contemplation turned into relationship. Because again, contemplation doesn't need to be just a private, personal, secret affair. I'm contemplating. But you can have a concrete fruit of a contemplative life in the form of relationships. It's are built around contemplation, and each relationship, each friendship, or each sangha or group becomes a very tangible form, embodied contemplation. That's ideally what a sangha should be. Spiritual community is like a embodied sample of contemplation, sample of embodied contemplation. Again, contemplation means you contemplate something. Again, interesting. Contemplation is an action. You contemplate, so you spend some time with something. You sit with something, with something, with someone. You offer your attention to that, which is the only thing we can offer in one sense. That's a currency that remains always available in the market. I have my attention. I'm offering that. That's how in Christianity use this expression: "You attend service." And attend comes from attention. But that makes no sense if you attend service and your attention is all over the place. You attend service means you are bringing your attention as the offering. That means you are in the service. If you are attend service and you are scrolling down your phone all day, you're not attending service.
So attending.
Yeah, attending, tending. And of course, as I mentioned in radical personalism, contemplation comes from the etymology means to be in the temple, to enter into a temple. Templum, contemplation, contemplum. And again, it doesn't mean just officially enter into a particular building that says temple. And now I'm doing contemplation. Not necessarily. But to realize the temple is everywhere. To relate and live in sacred ways that create the temple, and that's contemplative. So anyhow, let's go part by part from this verse, from through the verse. Verse starts saying matchita matgata prana. Now there's like a sequence I'm holding through the verse. So matchita, matchita means their chitta in this case will mean their minds. Mat in Sanskrit means Krishna saying upon me. So it's a short way of saying it literally means their minds upon me, which the idea is who their minds are fixed upon me. No, it's not saying detail, but that's the point. No? Their attention, their presence, and trying to explain it in a way that relates to where we are. No? For high devotees, yeah, the complete minds are absolutely absorbing me without interruption. That may not be our case, but that can be an aspiration and a conscious effort from where we are. No? What's an irresistible reality for the advanced devotees, just like their minds flow naturally there. For us, it may be a conscious effort to get there. And there is a virtue in that, till it becomes second nature. So, matchita matgata prana. As we say, those who bury lives, prana, are gata. Gata means it's consecrated to me. That's a way of translating it and can be related to where we are. So that's interesting because first comes matchita, no? Their minds are upon me, their minds are on me, and then immediately deepens in their lives are consecrated to me. So it's again, we will have silent time for personal contemplation, but I hope you spend already some time thinking, hey, what does this mean to me? No? To have my mind focus on the divine presence with the divine. Madgata prana to make my life oriented toward Bhagavan. Again, we may not be able to apply this line like, oh, Bhagavan is my life error, and without a moment of connection, I'm dying. May not be the case yet. But maybe you can say, okay, make God your topmost priority. Maybe you still have other priorities in your laundry list, but at least a way of defining a devotee is their priorities, God, to put it in love. I mean, their priorities is the priority. They understand which is the priority, the actual center of reality, and they make the center of reality their priority. So it's not a sectarian claim, it's just basic common sense. Well, if I understand this is the center of everything around which everything revolves, the source of everything. Okay, I think I will make that my priority. But that's the way of reading Madgata Prana. My life is consecrated in that direction. I'm making this divine reality my priority. Gradually, the life of my life, gradually investing my breathing. Breathing is a symbol for prana, for life. So I'm trying to align my life, align my breathing with this goal, this center. And matchita means I'm allowing my mind to contemplate more in that direction, which is a very important act. In our tradition, as much as we do many things in bhakti externally, ideally, the most important thing is what are we offering internally? Because I can be doing puja, I can be like in Archana, you're offering incense, lamp, chamara. But it is described in the manual that first you have to offer all the things in your mind. And the idea is first you have to offer yourself by offering those things in your mind. By making an effort to offer that, it takes some effort from you to do that. So it's a way of starting to offer yourself rather than just taking the thing and like, doo, 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 doo. I mean, anyone can do that. It's no different from building a robot, which I've seen in a few temples actually, that they move the things and do that. It's like, it's scary to see that because indirectly that's reflecting back what we often do.
Yeah.
That's why Krishna says, Nagita, offer me flower, fruit, water, whatever, but with bhakti, with heart, with your mind. Mind is, again, mind is, in Sanskrit, mind is also we use with heart. It's a word used with, sometimes we go, we in the West, we take mind from the neck up. But if you see many people in the East, when they say mind, they go here. So it's heart. If it works better for us, we use the word heart. Which is not literally the physical organ, but it's, ourself. So, of course, when we offer ourselves, or we try to align ourselves, our lives to that, naturally, whatever we do follows. So that's the first line of the verse. Again, I'm summarizing. We can stay for one line for a few days, but it begins depicting the devotee, Vaishnava. Again, aspirationally, if we feel that's a shoe too big for me at the present moment, but aspirationally, like falling in love with the idea. Now, in the beginning, we may not fall in love with Krishna fully, but we can fall in love with the idea of what Krishna is. But Krishna is not only an idea. We hear about the reality of divine love. Doesn't mean I'm there, but I can become attracted to what all that is, and that's how you start to get there. Well, as I like to say, sadhana bhakti could be described as a, as many ways, many things, but sadhana bhakti could be described as a theoretical appreciation of bhava bhakti and prem bhakti. I'm not there yet in that world of ecstatic emotion and full dedication, but I can start to appreciate that without being there. But the act of appreciating that is my only way of starting to be there, to get closer to that. So it's important that as sadhakas, we appreciate the higher realities. We do not rush into them trying to be there next weekend, but also we do not erase from the map either. We put them where they belong. It may be a long-term goal, but it remains on site. So there can be aspirational, and I can have that higher idea, like Srila Siddha Maharaj will say, we are being seen according to our ideal. Even if you are three lifetimes away from your ideal is putting your trajectory in context. Even if you feel I'm so far from that, but you sincerely cherish that ideal, because if that's the case, in one sense, you are on your way to that. And it doesn't matter how long it will take. No. The ideal, it's everything, he will say. No. So we shouldn't be so neurotized about where we still are in the present moment. And I'm this mess, and I'm this, and that. I mean, we need to work on that, I'm not saying, but also be very concerned about having an ideal deep enough, noble enough to give meaning and purpose to your life, even in the messiness of the present moment. Because if not, if you don't have that noble ideal, the only thing we have is just the messiness of the present moment. And sometimes that this becomes a little hopeless. And we become overly absorbed. This is the only thing there is. So to say, sorry. But if we have these noble ideals, middle term, long term, that we know they're real because we've seen people and met people who are inhabiting those ideals, and that gives so much hope and meaning and purpose and belonging and identity. And okay, we do not deny the current messiness, but in comparison to everything else, that's not the end of the story. That's never the final word. So Sadhu Sangha is a lot about that, about getting together and not just making our current messiness the center of the world, but realizing, oh, that's still there, but so much more is here. So let's go to the next line. And I hope I finish by 12. Sorry, stay one. We can transgress a little bit. Bodhayanta paras param. This one of my favorite lines. Bodhayanta parasparam. Parasparam is kind of parampara, which means one another. Parampara means one after another. Parasparam means one another. And bodhayanta means to enlighten. So my devotees enlighten each other or enlighten one another when they get together. That's a beautifully put. Sometimes we get this idea of enlightening, like this final point realization that I will get someday. And it's like, no, it's happening all the time when there is genuine sadhusanga. And it's mutual. It's mutual. Parasparam. Krishna is making it clear, it's always mutual. It never is a one-way street. It never is like, okay, here's Maharaj enlightening the 19 of you. But I'm receiving no light whatsoever from any of you. I'm just the giver of light. And you're just the receiver of light. That's madness. If I think like that, I'm going mad clinically. That's why Rupa Goswami, when he speaks about the loving interaction between the devotees, he always makes them reciprocal. No? The fourth verse of Upadeshamrita, Dadati, how it starts? Dadati prati grinati guhyamakiti prishti bhunkti bhojate chaiva. No, my devotees give and receive prasadam, give and receive gifts. No, give and no? Reveal their minds, receive their minds. He doesn't always only say one. One is the one who gives, the other is only the receiver. It's always happening two-way street. Because again, we are relational beings. Remember this foundational point. We are relational beings. We are mute. We exist in mutuality. As Martin Luther King Jr. will say, quote him in Evolution and Divine Love, he says, we are all caught in an inescapable network of mutuality. Nicely put. No? We are all caught in an inescapable network of mutuality. Thank God. So that's Sambandha. So therefore, sadhusanga is mutual. Sadhusanga is back and forth. Bodhayanta parasparam. You should say, my devotees awaken each other, illuminate each other, inspire, if you want to use the word, inspire each other, give life to each other, deepen one another. No? That's the greatest way of showing love to the other person, also. Like, we are here to enlighten one another. It's not what we are doing here. No. To do the opposite of that? No, thank you. I've done that enough. I have enough of that. So there's a very interesting horizontality in this line of the Bhagavad Gita. Everyone enlightens one another. Even when we sometimes speak in vertical terms, sometimes we say, okay, guru disciple sounds a little bit more vertical. But still, as we spoke the other day in the lecture on Guru Purnima in Wales, and as we've spoken in the past, even if there's a guru speaking to a disciple, ideally the guru has to be learning. No? That you are a guru, that you are more advanced means you have a greater capacity to learn, among other things. You may have a greater capacity to teach, but also a greater capacity to learn. No, it's not the more I increase my capacity to teach, the less I have to learn. I don't want that type of teaching. So as the disciple is learning from the guru is learning from the disciple and from everything around him, her. So we were talking the other day when Vyasadeva, the guru archetype or excellence, he's instructing Sukadeva Goswami in the Bhagavatam. And Sukadeva Goswami speaking the Bhagavatam. And Vyasadeva goes and sits in the audience. Parasparam, enlightening one another. I'm teaching you the Bhagavatam. I'm enlightening you, teaching you the Bhagavatam. And then eventually you teach me the Bhagavatam and enlighten me. That's the Bhagavatam template. Vyasadeva teaches Sukadeva the Bhagavatam. Narad Muni teaches Vyasadeva the Bhagavatam. Vyasadeva teaches Sukadeva the Bhagavatam, and then Sukadeva is talking the Bhagavatam and he's teaching, and he's, and Vyasadeva and Narad are both like being enlightened by the disciple and the disciple of the disciple. That's in the Bhagavatam. I'm not creating anything new here, it's just right there. Bodhayanta. Everyone is enlightened one another. Nobody thinking, oh, but he's your guru, he's your disciple, he cannot enlighten you in anything. Why not? Why to be so miser? Let's get enlightened in every possible direction. So again, we can be enlightened by elders, we can be enlightened by peers, we can be enlightened by juniors. So to say, in different ways, the relation may take different shapes, but you can be enlightened by your wife, by your father, by your sister, by your son, by your granddaughter, by a blade of grass, and so on and so forth. Sometimes Krishna may speak through me, through someone who knows less philosophy than I do, so to say, but has heard this verse through particular experience of, I don't know, surrender, gratitude, longing that I lack, suffering. And that person can shed light on this verse that I know better than him philosophically. And I can get this unique insight that's like, wow. That's new. No, they follow the point. So we should, the point from our side is to remain open to all that, to allow that to happen. So again, a devotee is not only someone to whom I explain Krishna. Many times the devotee is the place, how to say, the place where Krishna explains himself to me. It's mutual. Again, sometimes I may be speaking about Krishna to you, and many times Krishna will be speaking to me through you, even if you are not speaking about Krishna. That's the point. It's not that I have to be saying Krishna, oh, then it comes. Sometimes they want to have this idea, oh, Maharaj, I heard that lecture, and in the last 10 minutes, Maharaj never says Srila Prabhupada ever. We have a problem here. He never say Krishna, he never quote whatever, but maybe if you are having the experience of that person or reality without necessarily mentioning the name, it's like blaming Vyasadeva for not mentioning the name of Radha directly while the whole book is speaking about her, the Bhagavatam, right? Also, Bodhayan Taparashparam, of course, again, this is in the context of Sadhu Sangha, in the context of what we are trying to do here these days. And many times we may hear Bodhayan Taparashparam, enlightening one another in Sadhu Sangha, and immediately imagine speaking, right? Okay, I'm speaking to you and you're being enlightened, and then you speak to me and I'm being enlightened. But many times, if not all the time, mutual illumination requires deep listening. So sometimes I can enlighten you by listening to you, and vice versa, of course. Just not to underestimate Shravan. No wonder in the list of bhakti practice, first comes Shravan, then comes Kirtan. Kirtan is to speak. Kirtan is not only to chant, okay? It's not just chanting my rounds, picking mridanga, also to speak. That's kirtan also. But before comes Shravan, to listen. And listening is not only to go to the class and listen the class, it's to listen, to learn to listen, to listen in such a way that you can enlighten another person by listening. That's what Mahaprabhu did with Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, right? He sat in silence with the greatest pandit on earth. He listened from a very deep, loving place. And his listening converted him. He didn't say a word. 1 week, Maunavrata, no words. Just listening. He listened. So again, sometimes we may enlighten someone by saying something, saying some word that, oh, click, no, aha moment. And they may enlighten us in the same way. That's beautiful and totally complementary and required. But many times the enlightening comes from listening to the other person. And listening also means, of course, giving them enough sacred space, you know, for them to be, for them to express themselves. Spaciousness. You know, listening is spaciousness. It's not just I'm sitting in front of you without speaking. Because sometimes we think, oh, listening is not speaking. No. It's like repressing my need to speak all the time. Okay. Yeah, I'm listening. And you're counting the second when it's my turn. Oh, listening is, again, spaciousness. on giving the other person the spaciousness, the time, the space, for them to hear what they are discovering also. You know? Because when someone is expressing themselves, they're in the process of self-discovery, hopefully. And you can bear witness to that in silence, holding space, so they can reach whatever realization they need to reach. As we always say, listening is not just listening to then respond. Okay, what I will say in response. I have to have some smart thing to say, or to correct, or to preach, or to compare, or to offer advice, to tell the other person what to do with their life. Try to listen, and I'm saying that to all of us, me included, listen as though, again, the sweet absolute is revealing something to us through the other person. So listening for listening's sake, right? I'm listening because something is coming through me, through that person. Yeah, I'm holding space. Again, it's mutual. I'm holding space for the person to explore and express, but also something is coming through me. It's not that I'm just giving the other person the space by listening, by the person expressing him, herself, what's coming to me. So my listening is also paying attention to what's my lesson. All that is also about ayanta. That's my point. Enlightening one another. So we can really dissect what do we mean by enlightening one another? Because if not, it sounds just like, may sound a little even like fictitious. Okay, let's enlighten one another. No, okay. In real time, what does it mean? Right? How enlightenment takes place. Again, it's not just people think enlightenment is one time moment, but it's a process, a gradual process that takes place in this mutuality that this verse is speaking about. So, Machita, Madgata, Pranabodayanta, Bodayanta, Parasparam, Katayanta, Shamam, Nityam. Well, still, let's wait 1 minute before doing that. I have one quote here from Ramanujacharya in his commentary, something beautiful that he says in connection to what we just say. He says, the speakers are delighted by their own speech, no? Not narcissistically, because it is spontaneous without any ulterior motive. And what I just say, you are listening for the sake of listening, sharing for the sake of sharing, not with a calculated agenda. Okay, I will listen to Patrak, so let's see what I can get from that. Or I will be talking with this intention that as an outcome of my talking, I get this. No, it's spontaneous. Spontaneous means also there has been some safety in the environment to allow spontaneity. No? Because if nobody feels safe, there will be no spontaneity at all. Everything will be calculated, measured out of fear and what will they think and react. So when he says, oh no, the speakers derive great delight in their speech, not so much like, I'm so cool, what I'm saying, but more like, oh, I'm so glad that I can speak in this spontaneous way. I feel so free to trust. I feel so safe to be myself and be okay with who I am in this safe space. Oh, that for me, those are the implications of what Ramanujacharya is saying here. And also, they are speaking without any ulterior motive. Again, there's no calculation here. It's just for the sheer joy of communion, common union. And then he said, the listeners too feel the speech to be unsurpassingly and incomparably dear to them. No? So again, it's both directions. Confirmed.
That's true.
There's one parallel, somehow a parallel verse to this one, at least the first two lines. The Srimad Bhagavatam, which says, Satam prasangam mama bidyasam vido bhavanti karna rasayana kata. No time to go fully there, but Krishna says, Devadatta says, Satam prasangam, which is another way of saying sadhu sangha. Satam means sadhu, someone who is honest, who is all for sat, which means the truth. And he used the word prasangam, not only sangha. Pra means like special sangha. Now, of course, every sangha should be special, but sometimes in the name of sangha, we have just sandy feet social dynamics merely. Like church going on Sunday. Okay, see you next Sunday. Sure. So prasangam is real something special. As we know, sangha also means, as I always like to say, attachment. Right. So prasangam, satam prasanga, satam is honesty, truth. So satsanga means to get attached, to be honest with one another. That's what happens in genuine satsanga. You develop a healthy attachment through which you can relinquish all other attachments to honesty, to transparency, to truth, to vulnerability. So this verse says, Satam prasanga means such association, mama bidya sambidho, Krishna speaking. Mama bidya sambidho. Mama bidya means like strong, powerful strength and purple. My mama bidya sambidho, conversations about me, which are very powerful, come into the picture. In the circle of Sadhu Sangha, but also we have understanding this Bhagavad verse, Satam Prasanga, Mama Birya Samhita. In such honesty, when people get together in honesty, whatever conversation happens about me is birya, is infused with my power. So now words of Krishna saying, I descend myself in those conversations. Not like the Bible will say, with two or three gather in my name, I'm there. Here you have the Bhagavad version of it. In Satam Prasangam, Mama Birya, my force, my strength, my power is infused when people get together with honesty. Babhanti Hrit Karna Rasayana Kata. Tusyanti Katanjayanta Shamamichan, Tusyanti Charamanti is the same version. Babhanti Hrit Karna Rasayana Kata. So by doing that, these devotees experience in their heart, creating their karna and their ears, rasayana. No? They're engaged in rasayana kata. Rasayana is an Ayurvedic term to refer to like a tonic that gives that is very tasty but also very healing. So that cures you and also delights you. No? Tushyanti. So my association, my devotees get together, full honesty, I descend with full force. And they find full delight, full healing, by relishing together these conversations. A few more words about Bodaya and Taparashparam. We are getting to the third line in a moment. And of course, enlightening one another, no need to say it, but I will say enlightening one another doesn't mean that anyone arrives with finished conclusions. Finished realizations. Like, okay, I have the finished product here, you swallow it and you become enlightened by me. Huh? And also, my point with this is we get together in openness, but also we get together with our struggles and with our doubts, not just with our finished conclusions, which hopefully they are not, but with incomplete understanding, our messiness, and with our current relationship with this verse, which is not fine, it's never final. So that's healthy get togetherness. That's healthy sangha. That's a contemplative community, right? Contemplative community is not a community in which everyone comes pretending that they know everything. God forbid. Imagine, no? A community where everything comes, shows the table, pretending they have realized everything. Oof, cringy. No, it's part of the conversations are I don't know, I don't understand, I'm having this difficulty, I'm navigating through darkness, and somehow we can accompany each other in that night navigation. I remember recently I did a podcast with Tamal Krishna in Spanish, so feel free to learn Spanish. And he gave this example. He depicted Sadhu Sangha as how the bats are flying together in the night, no? Which they don't see anything. They don't see, literally. They're blind. So just by sound, they know where they're going, and they're flying full speed. So if they happen to crash, that's it. No? So they are going full speed in the dark. That sounds like a suicidal plan. But somehow they managed to navigate the darkness by each other's resonance. Huh? So that's a nice analogy for what Sadhu Sangha is. No, we not only again the enlightening, because we are speaking about enlightening, so it sounds all lighty. No, on light, it's all about light. No, there's darkness also. And how to navigate the darkness together, no? And accompanying with our frequency and our vibration and our support, like the bats are going. And sometimes it feels we are going full speed here. That may be a imminent and crash at any moment, and I don't see anything. The time lives may feel like that. No? Full speed, total darkness. So now what? If I jump out of the car, that's it also. So there are other people, like bats, guiding each other and accompanying each other and navigating darkness together.
So this also means don't stop talking about it then. Otherwise you do crash.
Of course, it doesn't mean don't stop talking literally,
Yeah,
but
but
keep the conversation open, keep the dialogue open. There's always something to be shared, no? And and flying together. Okay, Bhaktarasa once gave the example of the murmuring of the birds. It's another analogy of Sadhu Sangha, which is also beautiful in its own way, that it's they all move like one thing, but each one has their own flying style and contribution to the one thing. So it's one try, one circle, but each one is individuating in their own way, no? So different ways to speak about sometimes analogies help in this connection. And of course, since we're talking about Sadhu Sangha, I must briefly mention these important 3 points that Rupa Goswami says in Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. He says Sadhu Sangha, for it to be called as such, has to have these three ingredients. Swajatiya, I'm sorry, the whiteboard is filled, so I cannot write any other words. So feel free to write the Sanskrit in a very messy way, and then we can correct that. Swajatiya, snigdasya, swatavada. Swajatiya means with like-minded people. No? That you are practicing the same religion doesn't mean that you are like-minded. And it's okay. It doesn't mean that everyone has to be like-minded, like-hearted, sharing a similar nature, affinity, way of being and practicing. So, but you have to find those. Even if it's one more person. That's your try. That's your murmuring. That's your bat, whatever. Gang. Swajatiya. Then snigdasya means affectionate. No? Affectionate, snigdasya. Means it has to be affectionate. The interaction in that group has to be affectionate, because sadhu sangha doesn't getting together doesn't mean that there will be affection in interaction. And affection doesn't also necessarily only mean, oh, I love you so much, you are so nice. That's not only affection. Now, sometimes that can be evasiveness, too much of that. Sometimes, because I love you, I will tell you certain things that may be unsettling and uncomfortable because I love you. Or sometimes, as we spoke many times, that's another conversation. But if I love you unconditionally, let's put it hypothetically, sometimes I may need to put some conditions out of unconditional love, like a parent with a child. So all those things come into the word snigdasya. So we don't misread affection just as outward sentimentality that many times is a perfect excuse to for bypassing so many other things that are more uncomfortable and confronting and challenging. But affection means all that also, sitting with that. So genuine sadhu sangha has to have space for those things. And for everyone, hopefully understanding that's also part of love. That's also part of affection. It's not like, oh, you're abusing me by pointing to that. Or I feel attacked. I mean, you may feel all that, but at least we can sit on the table and trust each other if there's genuine affection. No, okay, behind our reading of the room or of the person, trusting there's genuine affection. Well, there is, of course. We need another retreat for those three words. And Swatavara is the third ornament of Sadhu Sangha. The Swatavara means one reading is you associate with people who are more advanced than you, so you can grow. But another reading is you associate with people, as I say before, Sadhu Sangha come from peer, from junior. You associate with people in such a way, Sat Sangha is so honest. that even if we are all peers, to give an example, Swatavara means we can still associate with something higher that flows through peers. Like, let's say we all, hypothetically, we're all Madhyam Bhaktas. If we are all Madhyam Bhaktas getting together in a very sincere way, some Uttam current may descend through us. Even none of us are there by ourselves. In our Madhyamness and honesty in getting together, we can invoke a current of Uttam revelation that is above each of us separately, but it's not above all of us getting together, so to say. Follow my point? So that's another way of reading Swatavar. So not to keep it just you associate with people who are higher than you, like only elders, only a little bit with that hierarchy, which is beautiful and it's necessary. But not to say, oh no, we are just peers, so nothing interesting can happen between us because we are not higher from one and than one another. No. You're honest and sincere, you'll find yourself saying and hearing things that is like, what's going on here? Or like you're, I happen, it happens sometimes to me by giving a lecture that I end up saying something like that. What was that? That was cool. But it was not me. I was not planning. So something higher came through me, but also by the grace of all of you. Because if you won't be here, I'm just sitting by my own in this seat and I start to talk by myself. No, that's not happening. Right? So it's something, it's collective, a collective phenomenon. So in that way, again, we are all becoming co-creators. Sadhusanga is a co-creation project. And even if it involves guru and disciple, they are working together for the same project. It's, again, it's not competition. They are all serving the same ideal. So the churning is mutual. Like, again, when Srila Siddharth will speak so many incredible things to those Prabhupada disciples who went to him in such a moment of need, but also very sincere willingness to dedicate himself, Srila Siddharth started to speak things that many of his disciple from India will say he never spoke those things before. So many of the things he's speaking now, of course, not to downplay who he was, but are also coming because of the genuineness and honesty of the inquiry, of the inquirers. That's also playing a role in his inspiration to discover new things, sure. And that way, guru disciple are again working together. That's why Rupa Goswami said, Bishram Bena Guru Seva. The connection with the guru has to be one of Bishram, but it's a type of friendly trust. And like it, the guru becomes a friend. We are working together on this project, honoring reality, serving reality together. As I say before, Sukadeva Goswami is enlightening Vyasadeva Naramani. No, nobody's having any problem with that. So the high seat, sometimes whenever someone gives a lecture, they give a special seat, they give a garland. But the high seat, the garland is not for the speaker. The high seat, the garland is for the flow that is supposed to come. And everyone is part of that flow. And we kind of maybe put a garland to each one of you and put a high seat to, but it's the one sitting, I'm happen to be sitting on this side on this fancy seat, but it's not for me. No, so it will be in one sense false humility for me to say, oh no, I don't want that fancy seat, but you should tell me, but that's not for you, Mara. That's for the flow. No, that is supposed to be happening through all of us. No, somehow you happen to be there, but it's a mutual participation. What do you think?
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah, beautiful. It's really beautiful.
So that's the idea, no? It's not so much as speaking again. Well, I am Taparashparam, still I'm there. I'm going to the third line. And this is important, no? All the things I'm talking, I know it's easy to go somewhere, forget that we are talking about this. But hopefully you can return to this and realize we have never left this verse. But there's so much that can be said about this verse that it seems that we are going somewhere else. only to realize, oh, so much is contained in these four lines. There's so much more. Again, we are just touching one point. So again, here the different here we are not trying to talk about Krishna, but trying more to speak, how to say, to speak about Krishna, but to speak Krishna into the room. No? That's the idea of Bodhayanta Parashvara. Speak Krishna, speak love, speak truth, whatever, no? Into the room. To imbibe that descent, imbibe that manifestation. Again, when two or three gather in my name. Or Naham, what is this verse? How it says? Naham tishtami vaikunte yoginam hridayesu vatatra tishtami narada matkayanti tamad bhakti. Krishna is saying to Narada, oh Narada, I'm not in Vaikuntha, I'm not in the heart of the yogis. I'm there when the few of my devotees get together and speak about me. So that's the same thing. Okay, let's go to the third line. Nityam. Beautiful. Katayantas chamam nityam. So kata, you know what kata means, to speak. Conversing, in this case. They are conversing, they are speaking. Mam, no? Cha means also, or and they also are. Katayantas cham, mam. Mam is about me. Nityam. Nityam means always, ever, forever, perpetually, all these type of things, no? To the endlessness, for the rest of forever. So again, people can speak about Krishna, I don't know, academically. People can speak about Krishna professionally. People can speak about Krishna casually, habitually. Like, oh, Hare Krishna. Sorry? Critically, people can speak about Krishna performatively. No, you can become a professional performer of Harikatha. There are many of them. No? Then they know how to speak Bhagavatam for a week, and they have lots of knowledge. They sing so nicely, have a very flashy turban and beard, and they're very charismatic, and they sing in tune, and you may end up thinking, oh, they're pure devotees. And they're just doing that as a job. They're waiting for their payment at the end of the 7 days and to continue their lives, which are not aligned with the Bhagavatam. But here, Katayanta Shamam Nityam is not suggesting any of that. That's my point. That suggests speech arising from absorption. I mean, speaks, this entails this, no? There's some sequence here. So this entails this. You speak from absorption, matitamatgatapran, of your mind, of your life, from mutual enlightenment. What have you received from that? No, you're speaking out of affection, with intention, with commitment. And as I said before, it's not so much about did you say Krishna or not in the last few sentences? No. Was Krishna the subject of conversation? But the idea is, did Krishna become more present during the conversation? It's not so much bringing the name or the word or this or that, but what became present during the conversation? So Krishna said, yeah, my devotees get together and enjoy this type of katha. No? As I said before, this kirtan, Srila Samaraj will speak many times about Krishna Harikatha's kirtan. I know some devotees, for some devotees, kirtan is only rounds. Kirtan is only harmonium, mridanga, kartal. But speaking about Krishna doesn't mean, again, I have to say Krishna, speaking about the things we are speaking about. All this is kirtan. Rupa Goswami mentions these nine limbs of bhakti from Shravana, Shravan Kirtan, Vishnu Smaranam, etc. He mentions one devotee that is like the acharya of each one, like the ideal representative. When it comes to kirtan, when it's first Shravan, the example is Parikshit Maharaj. He attained perfection by listening. When it comes to kirtan, he describes Sukadeva Goswami. Which was Sukadeva Goswami's kirtan? She spoke the Bhagavatam. He was not chanting japa. He was not playing mridanga, kartals. He was speaking. Katayantas Shramam Nityam. But he spoke so deeply that sometimes he will fall into a swoon, and then they need to make kirtan, play kartal and mridanga to bring him back to the swoon. That's a very interesting dynamic. One kirtan takes you to another place that you need to be brought back through other forms. At the end of the day, it's all kirtan all the way. So kata yanta shamam nityam. Again, nityam, speaking about this verse, speaking about very advanced people, could mean, okay, they never stop talking about Krishna. Of course, sometimes you stop talking for a second, but they cannot speak about anything but. That may sound a little bit aspirational for some of us, and still some other conversations may be there. And some of our acharyas have made it more realistic and sustainable. For example, there's this famous verse, Smarat Tavya Satatam Vishnur Bhishmarat Vyana Jata Chitsar Bibidini Sedasurita Yoriva. Always remember Krishna, never forget Krishna. All rules and regulations from the scripture are to serve these two principles. Okay, but always remember Krishna is like, oof, always means always. And never forget, he never means never. I'm not there. So how not to feel that I'm a total failure when, after reading that verse or after reading this verse? So many verses, Krishna Gita says, Satatam Kirtayantama. Always do kirtan. Mahaprabhu says, Kirtaniya Sada Hari. Sada means constantly. Go. Smartavya Satatam Vishnu. All these Satatam words, forever, ever, always, Nityam. Bhagavata Sivaya. Katayam Shamam Nitya. Always, perpetually, for it may create a little bit of like, I'm not doing that. I cannot do that even if I try. So Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur comments, and this doesn't mean for you to take this as an excuse, but just to see there is a nuance in between. He will say, oh, what does this mean? This verse means like always think about Krishna, never forget him. Oh, he said, well, at least once a day, remember Krishna. That means always. Always means every day. Now wake up. Jai Sri Krishna. Of course, he's not saying that to say, that's it, you don't need more. Just once a day. Don't bother with all this other stuff. He's not saying that, but he's saying, okay, well, some people may begin there, but need to begin there. Okay, once a day. No? So a generous reading by our Acharya, so we don't enter into a guilt trip. No? So we have to begin somewhere. So kata yantas samam. Okay, I'll go to the next line. I'm being brief now. Because somehow some of them are connected. Bodhayanta Parashparam was connected. Let's go to the last line. And again, I'm transgressing a little bit time today. Only today. I'm lying, I know. But today I gave half an hour of introduction to the whole series also. That won't happen tomorrow. This part of lunch also, please. We are being hopefully fed. So we already spoke. Now comes prayojan, the fruit of all this. Tushyanti cha ramanti cha, the fruit of this abideya, the fruit of acting in this way as a result of the sambandha from the previous verse. Krishna saying, I'm the source of everything. Tushyanti cha ramanti cha. No, cha means and or also. So if you say tushyanti means satisfaction, ramanti means delight, at least in one level of reading. Okay. No? My devotees become satisfied by doing all of the above. They find satisfaction and delight. Param drishya nivartana. They have it relish a higher taste. So they delight in sitting with one another and opening their hearts with one another and listening to one another. They're not doing all this out of duty, out of fear, out of institutional pressure or whatever. No? They're doing out of delight and fulfillment, and that brings even more fulfillment and delight. So this is the fruit that comes from the original thing, no? They get together, they remember, they consecrate their lives to my life, mutual illumination, loving conversation, satisfaction and delight. Because I'm saying all this because the verse does not begin with delight. Okay? My devotees sit together and they delight and they are finding satisfaction. No, you need to do some things to find delight and satisfaction. So you need to do the first things that the verse is saying. You need to get together from a place of integrity, honesty, satsanga, satam prasangam, honest presence, which entails vulnerability, transparency. Again, I will want to repeat all the things that I already said. Guhyamakyati when willing to reveal. Bring that quality of presence, hold that quality of presence in holding space. That will create a certain communion, connection, where there will be mutual enlightenment and enrichment and inspiration. And then we can speak about satisfaction and delight. Probably many times in life we lose satisfaction and delight without the first part. Without showing up or honestly and courageously and opening in mutuality and being willing to listen and to learn and to grow. So whatever pursuit of satisfaction and delight will be just a headache coming on your way. Of course, at the same time, we can bring a paradox here because Krishna says, okay, my devotees by doing this find satisfaction. At the same time, they find what we may call, and I call in my third book, holy dissatisfaction, which find they find, oh, now this is creating an unquenchable thirst for more. It's not like, oh, I'm fully satisfied, so I don't need to talk to you anymore because I'm fully satisfied now. So I'm going with my satisfaction to my room and my delight. No, I want more. That's why Nityam. The Nityam kind of interestingly comes Nityam, that comes to Shanti. They perpetually are doing this, and that gives them satisfaction, but not a satisfaction that cancels more of that. Right? Like this verse of the Bhagavatam in the 11th canto. Oops. Bhakti parishanubhava bhirattir anjata chatri saikakalam prapadya manasa tushti tushyanti, similar word. Krishna says, as someone practices bhakti, they develop further realization on me, further taste, and they get detached from inferior stuff. In the same way as someone who is eating, hungry person eating simultaneously experiences strength by the food, taste by the food, and less hunger, eradication of hunger. Those three things happen simultaneously. In the same way, the same thing happens in bhakti. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur comments, yes, this analogy of eating is nice, but it's not entirely accurate. Because when you are eating, there's a point that you eat and you are satisfied, but you cannot eat more. If you will start with more, then it becomes dissatisfaction. So you cannot say, you cannot apply that idea to bhakti. In bhakti, there is no more, there's no point we say, I have enough of this stuff. I'm filled, no more. There's always room for more. So that's a little bit the paradox with Sushanti. Yes, satisfaction, delight, but ongoing in ever-evolving progress. A few thoughts I want to share with you today regarding this verse of the Gita, which hopefully, if you knew already the verse, hopefully we were able to bring some new light into it so we can be all humbled and not take for granted passages that are there for time immemorial. And well, yeah, I know that. And of course, briefly, I don't want to go into the detail. But remember, this is the second of four verses, these substantial verses of the Chaturshloki of the Gita. And then the next two verses, which we will not be exploring, but basically are about how Krishna responds to this, to such devotees, to such gathering. Krishna responds by giving them deeper understanding. He enters their hearts, dispels their darkness through compassion. So we have this sequence in the Chaturshloki of the Gita. No? In the previous verse to this, verse 8, as I say, Krishna reveals himself. I'm the source of everything. Everything emanates from me. In this verse, okay, how devotees respond to that, how devotees help one another, to connect with that source. And in verses 10 and 11, how Krishna reveals himself more deeply and more deeply and more deeply to them. No? And again, in talking about more deeply, Śrīla Śrīmad will interpret these whole verses in terms of the gopis being in separation from Krishna. No? And Tushyanti cha, Ramanti cha, he will translate them as Tushyanti, I feel inclined to serve Krishna in romantic mood, and Ramanti means to serve Krishna in parakīya mood, in the mood of the illicit lover in the Leela. And then the next verse is when Krishna says, I dispel the darkness of ignorance, means Krishna dispelling the darkness of separation in which the gopis are dying for him, and how he reappears to them, and very beautiful and interesting ideas that, again, it will take more time to, I trust you can go on. Do your own exploration. So it's 12 p.m. So apparently it's the time for concluding, and it is. But I like to conclude, and that's the extra time. I'm not transgressing that much. I like to conclude with an exercise, no, that we can do. That may take maximum 15 minutes. So we are. That's the transgression time, and there are, and I'm not inviting you to bring questions now because, again, we have already transgressed enough. And but in the evening we have Q&A, no? So in the evening we'll have question and answer. If you have any doubts or themes or something you would like to explore more about this verse or anything, it's not limited to the morning verse of the day for the evening Q&A. But if there's something pending, write that down and bring it into the evening. So I will briefly mention, it's a simple exercise just to continue churning and bringing this verse into actuality, you know, like in motion, playing it out in interaction and listening and sharing with one another, as we've been doing for years already. So we'll be forming groups of three, or according to the numbers we are. And each person, as usual, I have my gongs here. Thank you, Manjali. So I will be marking the time. Each person will be speaking for 2 minutes each. I will give two prompts. Okay. So one prompt, 2 minutes, then I click, hit the gong. The next person speak for 2 minutes. The other two listening without interrupting, without correcting, advising, bearing witness, holding space. So 2 minutes, 2 minutes, 2 minutes, and then the second prompt. So I will mention the two prompts now. Just in case you want to know them, write them down. If not, I will remind them. So the first one is, what does real sadhu sangha mean for me? I mean, for me means for each one of you at this stage of my life. Yeah? Because we may have had different ideas of what sadhu sangha, different definitions. So what's sadhu sangha mean to you now? What does real sadhu sangha, real is a redundant word because sadhu means sad, real. So, what does real sadhu sangha mean for me at this stage of my life? Okay, so each one will be sharing for 2 minutes, and the other two will be bearing witness to that. And the second question will be, or is, how am I being invited to become better sadhu sangha for others? Because remember, it's not just receiving sadhu sangha like a gift we are consuming, like a product. By offering, becoming sadhu sangha for others. So, how I am being invited to become better or sadhu sangha for others? How do I call? How do I feel that calling? Which ways? So, I will stop the recording here, and then I'll select the groups. We'll make the exercise, and then we'll conclude today's gathering. And later, I will be sharing with you a writing contemplative prompt for the afternoon based on this verse. So what I'm thinking for that, to not to make it too long now, I can share it in the WhatsApp group. And those of you who are not checking the WhatsApp group, go to some who are, and they at least can show you the screen and you can write it down and you take it with you in the contemplative time. So after the class, after breakfast, you will find that in the WhatsApp group. Okay. Srimad Bhagavad Gita ki jai, Sriman Mahaprabhu ki jai, Harinam Sankirtan ki jai, Gaur Premanand Hari Om.